I've read this intro several times. I stared into the mirror in sheer disbelief. That's not me. That can't be me, I screamed. I, Kathleen Lutz, am a young, blonde-haired housewife with pale, soft skin. But that's not what I saw in my reflection. I had turned into a disgusting-looking 90-year-old hag. My hair was white and scraggly. Ugly creases and crow's feet scarred my face. I drooled all over my shriveled-up, dried skin. It was the work of horrible, evil spirits that had plunged my family and me into chilling terror for 28 days, that turned our dream house into a hell house. Turn the page now and go on with the story. Now, you'll be able to read that. But there are some more. I might keep this thing going for a couple of 3 weeks. We'll be able to get this one for the following Sunday at King's House 1. Start off January right on this subject of demonology. The Amityville Horror 2. The terror continues. A sharp scrape, a moan, an elongated complaint from the floorboards. The beds, he thought. Something was moving the beds of his stepsons, dragging them across the floor of their third-story room. I've got to get up. George tried to rise, but a blast of icy wind slammed him back against the mattress. I've got to get up, he repeated, and tried again. A smothering, invisible force like a huge fingerless hand pressed him against the bed. The box springs groaned at the sudden strain. There was a shouting upstairs. Something was clattering in the halls. A door slammed. A drawer shot free. The band yattered and screeched on the staircase. And now he couldn't scream, he couldn't breathe. Something was stealing the air out of his lungs. No, I've got to get up. I've got to get to the boys. I've got to... No, no. Fence or the force closed over him. George blacked out. That's the intro to number 2. And then there's a third one. Amityville. The final chapter. Millions know of the horror that haunted the Lutz family and their famous house in Amityville, Long Island. Millions shared their terror when they fled and shared their hope when they tried to fight the evil with exorcism, told in Amityville 2. But their hopes were cruelly shattered when the horror returned to stalk them and their children to the ends of the earth. For the force was even more evil and more determined than before. Now read the shocking conclusion to the nightmare that has terrified more people than any other true story ever told. Now, I know that you're getting bored with all these demonology subjects. That's why I gave us some R&R with Jeremiah. And I'll go back to Jeremiah. But I have one goal. To prove up the truth of God's Word. There has been the feeling that you cannot be intelligent. You can't be a modern man, really, and believe the Bible. I preach a sermon out of the Song of Asher. The God of the forefront is our refuge. On the corner before we get there. The claim of the New Testament church concerning Christ is that he's not only the Alpha, the beginning, but the Omega. The unrelenting message I preach is that God's in control. The greatest promises of God's book single out a particular name of God. And that name, the Lord of hosts. Jehovah, as I've explained the meaning of the word, it's a pictorial word, conveys the understanding of God wanting to reveal Himself as a force ready to be released. To an oracle people He had chosen to reveal Himself to, and to make the channel of that revelation to the world. Particularly were singled out for the revelation of the Jehovah traits. Each one of those traits have God particularized to the needs of man at the moment. Most of them are like rifle shots. The Lord will provide is the answer to anxiety about provision. The Lord is my shepherd is the answer to your anxieties about the future and the path you're taking. The Lord our peace is the answer to the anxieties about the uncertainties and the stress of this world, that in Him you're safe because He's before, after, and above, and in and through it all. No name shifts quite as much from the need at first glance to the answer as the Lord of hosts. Whatever your need may be, the declaration there is God's more than enough for it, because every element is at His disposal to use whatever the need. Hosts of inanimate objects. Man's excited today because they created a 2-minute comet. All these things are my hand made, God says. He controls the hosts of human forces. He can make heathen serve His purpose. He bends the stream of history to cross the intersections of His sovereignty. But nothing is as frightening. And that, I think, is why modern man sticks his head in the sand like an ostrich and ignores it. As supernatural, intelligent, personified forces of evil. Not just the terrifying forces of impersonal evil, which you can always confront with the hope that man somewhere will gain by his own intelligence the ability to, if not master those forces, escape or relate to them in a way he can survive. Confrontation with inexplicable, supernatural, unseen, personified, intelligent beings bent on evil. The Bible recognized that as the major conflict of the age. The Bible represents that as the major target of God's power, the major attempt to threaten His sovereignty. And we're caught between. Now, in the marriage with reason and naturalism and the deification of humanism, there wasn't any room for these supernatural forces. But as the end approaches, it's as though God is forcing a sweeping onto the center stage the events that prove His revelation. Now, we cannot neglect in the attempt to prove up God's Word. We cannot neglect these demon realities. If there are no demons, and if there is no intelligent, supernatural, invisible, personified beings of evil, then the Bible is myth. The Bible is a creature of a superstitious age. You cannot take the Hebraic frame and the New Testament frame and divorce it from their acceptance of this conflict of the ages. A fallen Lucifer, who was once a crowning cherub on the mountain of God, who still has access to God's throne, who is the perennial accuser of the brethren, the purveyor of guilt, who held the power over man that was the power producing more fear than any other single power, the power of death, and who lost in the battle for those keys of death and hell and the grave, and who never ceases, though obviously aware of the ultimate outcome, to fight against God's expression of faithfulness, which gives integrity and meaning to life. Now, I'm not going to stay off of demonology because it is not too intellectually palatable at first glance. And as I usually do in my teaching, I sweep enough onto the stage that even if you're skeptical of a bit of it, or even a lot of it, I deal in those matters that there's such overwhelming evidence that you can't ignore it if you're an intelligent person, other than by doing what I referenced earlier, sticking your head in the sand and putting that part up in the breeze that so much of the traditional church leaves hanging there and thinks it's a flag. I got the Lord, that's enough, saying. The Amityville Horror. True story. Now, I'm really moving along fast because I got two more I got to read. Here's the Amityville Horror 2. And Amityville, the final chapter. I usually move along fast, but I'm speeding it up a little tonight, even faster than normal. Somebody said to me last night, Dr. Scott reads 4 or 5 books a year. I mean, a day. How come it takes him 2 years to read one on TV? George couldn't understand why Kathy said he was yelling, I'm coming apart. Now, answer the phones over at King's House 1. And if you're coming to my banquet Sunday, December 30th, at 2 p.m. at the Bonaventure, and you haven't had a call back confirming it, you better call and leave a phone number, because my staff's confirming tonight. And time's a-wasting. So they'll answer the phone while I read over at King's House 1. And if you haven't been called back and confirmed, you better get on telephone. That's for buses as well as the banquet itself. George couldn't understand. Why did Kathy say he was yelling, I'm coming apart? He knew perfectly well what he had said was, I'm coming unglued. Isn't that right? Now, he remembered he had been sitting in the chair when suddenly he felt a powerful grip lift up the chair with him in it and slowly turn him around. Powerless to move, George saw the hooded figure he had first seen in the living room fireplace. Its blasted half face glaring at him, the horribly disfigured features became clearer to George. He recognized him. God help me! He screamed. Then he saw his own face emerge from beneath the white hood. It was torn in two. I'm coming unglued, George yelled. I would unglue you, wouldn't it? But what he meant was his own head was coming unglued under that hood. I'm boring you? Frustrating you? Well, you're still alive. Now, still groggy, he began to argue with Kathy. I know what I said, he muttered. Don't tell me what I said. The others backed off. He's still asleep, Kathy thought, and he's having a bad dream. "You're right, George," she said gently. "You didn't say that at all." She pulled his head to her breast. "Daddy," Missy broke in, "come to my room. Jody says he wants to talk to you." The urgency of his daughter's voice broke the spell. George snapped out of it and jumped up, almost bowling Kathy over. "Jody, who's Jody?" "That's her friend," answered Kathy. "You know, I told you she makes up imaginary people. You can't see Jody." "Oh, yes, Mama," Missy protested. "I see him all the time. He's the biggest pig you ever saw." Then she trotted out of the room and was gone. George and Kathy looked at each other. "A pig?" He said, it struck them both at the same time. They remembered the cloven hoofs and the snow, the prints. "The pig's in her room. George ran after Missy. You stay here," he yelled at Kathy and the boys. Missy was just climbing on the bed when George stopped outside her bedroom door. He didn't see Jody or anything like a pig. "Where's this Jody?" he asked Missy. "Oh, he'll be right back," the little girl said, setting the covers around herself. He had to go outside for a minute. George let out his breath. After the weird dream of the hooded figure, George had expected the worst when he heard the word pig. His neck felt stiff, and he rotated it, trying to work out the tight feeling. "It's all right," he yelled back to Kathy. "Jody's not here." "There he is, Daddy." George looked down at Missy. She was pointing to one of her windows. His eyes followed her finger, and he started. Staring at him through one of the panes were two fiery red eyes. No face. Just the mean little eyes of a pig. "That's Jody," cried Missy. "He wants to come in." Something rushed past George on his left. It was we've even joined some of these cities. It's very clear that unseen, powerful forces of evil personified Lucifer and his agents, the devil and his hierarchy of lieutenants, fallen angels, and demons are there to oppress. Paul said, "We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and power." I'm, from many sources, showing you there's a lot of evidence that such forces do exist. We've moved across the gamut from the Judaic Encyclopedia to the poltergeist in John Wesley's house, his parents' house. Now I'm reading The Amityville Horror, a true story by Jay Anson. A movie was made of it. There's more to the story than the movie gave you. George has just run into Missy's room. I'm on page 247. So you can remember, because I'm going to give this book away at the banquet. Answer the phones now at King's House 1. Don't take any more calls in here. Finish the ones you have. Go ahead and finish. Just try to keep your voice down. Lower the lights. I want to read. George has just run into his little girl's room, Missy's room. She keeps seeing a pig called Jody, a manifestation of the demon force that's been terrorizing. George runs in the room, doesn't see anything. It's all right, he yelled back to Kathy, his wife. Jody's not here. Now, they've found cloven hoof prints in the snow. The little girl is always talking about this Jody. He yelled back at Kathy, his wife, Jody's not here. There he is, Daddy. George looked down at Missy. She was pointing to one of her windows. His eyes followed her finger, and he started. Staring at him through one of the panes were two fiery red eyes. No face. Just the mean little eyes of a pig. That's Jody, cried Missy. He wants to come in. Something rushed past George on his left. It was. That's where we were. Something rushed past George on his left. It was. That's exactly where we were. Are we in agreement on that fact? Something rushed past George on his left, not on his right, on his left. Sinister. It was something rushed past George on his left. Wasn't what he thought it was. It was Kathy. Thank God it was Kathy. Screaming in an unearthly voice. In the same move that it took her to reach the window, she picked up one of Missy's little play chairs and swung it at the pair of eyes. Good! Now we're getting somewhere. Her blow shattered the window and shards of glass flew back on top of her. There was an animal cry of pain, a loud squealing. And the eyes were gone. George rushed to what was left of the second story window and looked out. He saw nothing below, but he still heard the squealing. Now, I don't believe this, but I'm starting to. It sounded as if it was headed for the boathouse. Then Kathy's crying whimper caught George's attention. He turned to his wife. Kathy's face was terrifying. Her eyes were wild, her mouth was tightly screwed up. She was trying to choke out words. Finally, she blurted, "It's been here all the time. I wanted to kill it. I wanted to kill it." And then her whole body slumped. George caught his wife and silently picked her up. In the meantime, Father Mancuso, still battling the attacks of Satan himself, trying to get permission of his bishop to do something about it, calls on his bishop again. He's ordered to stay away from it. Later in the day, Kathy was given Missy her lunch. Kathy was watching Missy eat. The little girl seemed to be having a secret conversation with someone under the kitchen table. Every once in a while, Missy would extend her hand beneath the plastic tablecloth to offer her peanut butter and jelly sandwich. She didn't seem to be aware her mother was watching her movements. From her position, Kathy could see there wasn't anything under the table. But she didn't want to ask her daughter about Jody. But finally, she said, "Missy, is Jody the angel you told me about?" The little girl looked at her mother, confusion on her face. "You remember," Kathy continued, "you asked me if angels speak." Missy's eyes lit up. "Yes, Mama." She nodded. "Jody's an angel. He talks to me all the time." "I don't understand," her mother said. "You've seen pictures of angels." Missy nodded again. "You said he's a pig, so how can you say he's an angel?" Missy's eyebrows grew together as she concentrated. "He says he is, Mama. He told me." "What does he say when he talks to you?" Again, the little girl seemed confused. "You know what I mean, Missy. Do you play games?" "Oh, no. He tells me about the little boy who used to live in my room. He died, Mama. The little boy got sick and he died." "I see. What else did he tell you?" "Last night he said I was going to live here forever so I could play with the little boy." Horrified, Kathy put her finger to her mouth, because she wanted to scream. George's session with the IRS hadn't gone very well. Birds of a feather flock together. On top of everything else, the IRS is auditing George. When he arrived home, Kathy and Missy had their coats on. "Don't undress, George," she said. "We're leaving for my mother's right now." "I'm going to move." George and the two boys looked at her. "What happened?" he asked. "Jody told Missy he's an angel. That's what happened, and we're getting out of here." George held up his hands. "Wait a minute, will you? What do you mean he's an angel?" "Missy," Kathy said, "tell your father what the pig said." "Well, he's an angel, Daddy. He told me." George was about to ask his daughter another question when he was interrupted by loud barking behind the house. "Harry," he cried. "We forgot about Harry." When George and the others reached him, Harry was barking furiously at the boathouse, frantically running around his compound, jerking up short every time he reached the end of his steel leash. "What's the matter, boy?" George said, patting the dog's neck. "Someone in the boathouse?" Harry twisted out of his grasp. "Don't go in there," Kathy yelled. "Please, let's get out of here now." George hesitated, then bent down, snapped the leash off of Harry's collar. The dog leaped forward with a savage snarl and ran out of his gate. The door to the boathouse was closed, and the best Harry could do was leap against it. Again, he started his wild barking. George was all set to unlock the door and fling it open. A That's on page 253. Let's move on. You can finish that if you come to the banquet. In the meantime, Father Mancuso still so worked up, the bishop won't let him do anything. Father Mancuso, it says, was an individual who despised bullies, be they man, animal, or the unknown. The priest felt that the force that had 112 Ocean Avenue in his grip was taking undue advantage of the fears of the Lutzes and of himself. The priest knew there was only one answer. It had to be demonic. I'm getting somewhere. Just to be on the safe side, George and Kathy decided the children should sleep in the master bedroom. With Harry inside, down the cellar. We skipped over, you know, what happened out there. Danny, Chris, and Missy were put to bed. George and Kathy made themselves as comfortable as they could. Kathy stretched out on two chairs. George insisted he was all right with one. He told Kathy he planned to stay awake all night and sleep in the morning. At 3:15 a.m., George heard the marching band strike up downstairs. I don't believe any of this, but I'm starting to. This time he didn't go to investigate. You know, there are lots of people that are calling on these phones telling us of similar experiences that they've been afraid to tell anybody because they figured people think they were crazy. At 3:15 a.m., George heard the marching band strike up downstairs. This time he did not go to investigate. He told himself it was all in his head. And when he went down, there'd be nothing to see. So he sat there, watching Kathy and the children, listening as the musicians paraded up and down his living room, horns and drums blasting away loud enough to be heard a half mile away. All during the maddening performance, Kathy and the children did not awaken. Finally, George must have dozed off in his chair because Kathy awoke to hear him screaming. She ran to her husband's chair on the other side of the bed to shake him out of his dream. George began groaning, and when Kathy touched him, he cried out in another completely different voice, "It's in Chris's room! It's in Chris's room! It's in Chris's room!" George is positive he wasn't dreaming. From his position, he was sure he could see clear to the boy's bedroom on the third floor. He had been watching a shadowy figure approach Chris's bed. He tried to rush to his sleeping son's side and grab him away from the menacing shape, but George couldn't get up from his chair. He was pinned to the seat by a firm hand on his shoulders. It was a struggle George knew he couldn't win. The shadow hovered over Chris. George, helpless, shouted, "It's in Chris's room!" That's on page 259. They made up their mind to leave. Skipping over the thing that happened that you can read when you get the book on Sunday. That terrorized them to the point they finally were ready to leave. But when they started to leave, a storm drove them back in the house. By 6 in the evening, the storm still hadn't slackened. It was as though all the water in the world was being dumped on top of 112 Ocean Avenue. And inside the house, the temperature was up to 90 degrees. George went to the basement to look at the oil burner. It was off, but it didn't matter. The heat continued to rise in all rooms except Missy's. Desperate, George decided to make a final appeal to God. They're sort of slow getting around to God and leaving. I mean, there are two things they're really slow. Exiting and praying. Holding a candle, George began going from room to room, asking the Lord to send away whoever didn't belong there. He felt mildly reassured when there was no sinister reaction to his prayers. And I'm reading the Amityville Horror, a true story, and I'm reading it in the matrix of having read off and on for several weeks of strange, inexplicable happenings that have an explanation if the biblical view of demonology is true. And what are Christians doing about the biblical view of demonology? My quarrel with traditional Christianity, they think the poor stumbling saints are the target. They're shoot-for-Jesus hitmen practicing on fellow Christians that make mistakes. At least the Catholics, the demonologists Ed and Lorraine Warren, know who the enemy is. About time the church started recognizing who the true enemy is. Let's go on. He felt mildly reassured there was no sinister reaction to his prayers. After the playroom door had been damaged during the first storm, George had removed the lock. Now as he approached the room to recite his appeal to God, he saw the green slime was back. Now we skipped over that. Leaking, the green slime was back. Leaking from the open hole in the door and oozing onto the floor of the hallway. George watched as the pool of jelly-like substance slowly wound its way down toward the staircase. He pulled off the pine boards nailed across the door and threw it open, half expecting the room to be filled with the slimy material. But its only source seemed to be the empty lock hole in the door. George gathered some towels from the third floor bathroom and stuffed them into the opening. The towels soon became saturated, but the jelly stopped flowing. He wiped up the slime that had accumulated in the hallway and had managed to flow down the steps. George had no intention of telling his wife about this latest discovery. A few other things happened. It's bedtime. Tonight, he thought, I'd better be ready for anything. George put on Harry's long metal leash and took the dog up to the master bedroom. He left the door open but knotted the leash so that Harry blocked the doorway completely. Then George kicked off his shoes and, without undressing, slid into bed beside Missy and Kathy. Rather than lie down, he sat up with his back resting against the headboard. At 1 o'clock, George felt he was freezing. Because of the noise of the raging storm outside, he knew there's no hope of heat in the house that night from the oil burner. He began to weep to himself about the sorry plight he and his family were in. He now realized he should have fled when Father Mancuso originally warned him. Oh, God, help us, he warned. Suddenly, Kathy lifted up her head. While he watched, she got off the bed and turned to look into the mirror on the wall. George saw in the candlelight that her eyes were open, but he knew she was still asleep. Kathy stared at her reflection for a moment, then turned away from the mirrored wall and started for the bedroom door. But she stopped when she came to an obstacle. Harry was fast asleep, stretched across the threshold, blocking her path. George leaped up from the bed, seized his wife, and Kathy looked at him with unseeing eyes. To George, she seemed to be in a trance. Kathy, he cried, wake up! When George shook her, there was no response or reaction. Then her eyes closed. Kathy went limp in his arms. And gently he half lifted her back to the bed. First he sat Kathy down, then straightened her legs so she was lying flat. Her trance-like state seemed to affect her whole body. She was like a rag doll. George noted that Missy, in the middle of the bed, had slept through the whole episode. But then his attention was diverted by a movement in the doorway. He saw Harry struggle to his feet, shake violently, and then begin to retch. The dog threw up all over the floor. It kept gagging and trying to force out something that seemed stuck in his throat. Restricted by his leash, the poor dog was only twisting the chain more tightly about his writhing body. The odor of vomit caused George to gag too. There was a noise above George's head. He looked up and listened. Something was scraping along the floor of the boy's bedroom. The noise became louder, and George could tell the movement was faster now. The boy's beds were sliding back and forth. George managed to throw off his covers, but he couldn't lift his body out of bed. There was no pressure as there had been before when he sat in the bedroom chair. George just didn't have the strength to move. Now he heard the dresser drawers across his room begin to open and close. A candle was still on his nightstand, and he could make out the drawers rapidly sliding back and forth. One drawer would fly open, then another, then the first would bang shut. Tears of frustration and fear flooded George's eyes. Almost immediately after that, the voices began. He could hear them downstairs, but couldn't make out what was being said. He only knew that it sounded as if a lot of people were thronging on the first floor. George's head began to roll as he tried to reach over and touch Missy or Kathy. Then the marching band struck up downstairs. Its music drowning out the unintelligible voices, George thought he must be in a madhouse. He could distinctly hear the musicians parade around the entire first floor and then their first steps as they began to mount the staircase. George was screaming now. Finally, George gave up. He realized the mattress was soaking wet. The beds were banging around above George's head, and the dresser drawers in his room were flying back and forth as the band headed up the steps to the second floor, but that was not all. Despite all the noise, George now heard doors throughout the house beginning to slam back and forth. He saw the door to the bedroom swing wildly as though someone were yanking it open and then immediately slamming it shut. George could also see Harry lying outside in the hallway, completely undisturbed by the racket. Either that dog is drugged, George thought, or I'm the one who's going mad. The terrible, blinding flash. Of lightning lit up the bedroom. George heard the thunderbolt strike something close outside. Then there was a smashing blow that shook the entire house. George lay there panting, his heart thumping loudly in his chest. He was waiting, knowing something else was about to happen. Then George let out a horrible, silent scream. Somebody was on the bed with him. He felt himself being stepped on. Strong, heavy feet struck his legs and body. George shut his eyes. He could feel the pain from the blows. Oh, God, he thought, they're hooves. It's an animal. Oh, you don't want me to continue? That's page 272. You want me to continue?